Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding foreign policy in the COVID-19 era. My name is Richard McGregor and I'm a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. In this episode, I'll be talking to Shivshankar Menon, formerly both Foreign Secretary and National Security Advisor in India, and also his country's former ambassador to India as well. This interview is one of a series of three that we're doing on Chinese foreign policy. So Shankar, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Look, I want to start with a general question. If you look at China's in conflict, not just with the US, but with many countries in different ways, Canada, the UK, Australia, India, of course, and we'll come to that in detail later, Europe and the like. Now, we often hear that the Chinese are great strategists, but I'm wondering if you see any strategy to the way their policy is unfolding at the moment, or is it just the price that has to be paid by a rising power as it rises?
I'm not sure that there's this 100-year plan, or that, in fact, sometimes I wonder whether the whole rational actor model that we use is entirely applicable to everything that states do, certainly the People's Republic of China. Because, I mean, people do things because they can. People do things because they enjoy them. Why do we think states are different? Why do we think states are just collections of leaders and people? So I'm not sure that there's some grand strategy. But what I see happening in the last few years with China's policy is it has turned increasingly nationalistic and is increasingly driven by domestic factors rather than by a sense of how the world has changed. There is, of course, I think, an increasing sense in Peking that the world has become much harder, much more negative towards China, that it's a harsher environment. And I think that what's happened in China-US relations, especially under the Trump administration, but before that, has probably convinced them that the world is determined to prevent the rise of China and that China therefore needs to push back, be much more assertive. And that's what we're seeing, a much more nationalistic, actually an almost autistic China pushing across the board. You look at her periphery with Japan in the Senkakus, you look at Taiwan, look at Hong Kong, look at South China Sea, you with ASEAN and the others, with India on the border. So I think this is primarily domestically driven. Whenever there's domestic stress in China in the past, we've seen a much firmer, tighter, stronger sort of Chinese posture abroad. So I'm not sure that this is a rational response to the changes in the world, to the backlash to globalism, to the fragmentation of the global economy, to the slowing world economy, and now the pandemic and the crash that this has occasioned. This is clearly not the best response because, as you said, China's probably more isolated than she has been ever since the Cultural Revolution. And that's not what foreign policies are normally designed to achieve.
Yes, you find some Chinese argue, of course, that, you know, many of the countries I've listed are Western countries, but if you look around the world, perhaps Latin America, perhaps Africa, perhaps in continental Asia, China's relations may be better with those countries. But do you think that's a fair argument at all, that my analysis might be a little bit too Western-centric?
Well, I would argue that China's actually not doing badly in Asia in terms of outcomes. Not in terms of popularity, not in terms of being liked or in terms of getting friends, but in terms of outcomes, she's not doing badly on the continent. She is consolidating the Eurasian landmass. Frankly, US policy has pushed both Iran and Russia into her arms, and she's pushing at an open door in Asia with the Belt and Road, with railways, roads, trade, investment, now fiber optic connectivity, and so on. What is contested is really the seas around China. And it's the entire Indo-Pacific. It's a maritime domain which is contested. For China, there's two problems, I think, today, which she has to get her head around. One is she is increasingly powerful, but for the first time, she's dependent on the rest of the world. This is not something she's known in history. She's not used to needing the world. And I don't mean just in terms of imports and exports, but in terms of the fundamentals, energy, in terms of commodities. I mean, she can't run her economy and stay prosperous, strong, or grow without the world. And that dependence is something that I think doesn't come easy. Second is this, because of that dependence, the transition to being a maritime power, which historically she has not been, despite whatever myths one might tell each other about Zheng He. And it takes a long time to start thinking like a maritime power and to behave like one. You know, I mean, even South China Sea, she treats as territory, as territorial sea, and she tries to dominate it from she creates islands and land and uses basically land-based missiles, fighters, etc., to try and control it. It's a very different mindset because the seas are positive sum. You know, nobody can control all the waters, all the choke points all the time. Land, territory belongs to either you or me. I mean, this is zero sum. And I think this double transition, I think China is finding hard. But she's not doing badly on land. Because there's two things happening here. It's not only China's actions. It's also the U.S. now seems, at least under the Trump administration, to be a revisionist power and no longer interested in running a global order on her own. So you have this strange phenomenon where, at least in Asia, it's evident that countries hedge against both China and the US. And it might actually be a middle power moment, a moment when there is space because of China-US contention for other powers to actually maneuver. But it's still very hard to tell because China-US is not China-Soviet. It is not U.S.-Soviet. It's not another Cold War. If anything, it's, you know, yes, there is competition, but they are also joined at the hip economically. They cannot decouple without doing real damage to each other. And this is true of all of us. It's true of India. It's true of Australia. We might have very strong, contentious elements in our relationship with China, but we also cannot do without China.
That's right. Now, let me bring you back to a point you made earlier before getting to India. That is, in other words, the domestic drivers of current Chinese foreign policy. Obviously, the domestic driver is Xi Jinping. China has taken a sharper authoritarian turn under Xi Jinping, and he's enunciated goals for the country and the China dream and the great rejuvenation and the like. Are we seeing in the rest of the government, the foreign policy apparatus, the PLA, a concerted effort to work up to Xi Jinping? In other words, to execute what they think he wants them to do?
I think that's right, that one-man rule or authoritarian rule and the centralization of power, and actually the changes in decision-making processes, which have been brought about in the last 6 years, I think those actually promote this kind of policy. I mean, China spends, you know, what, $21 billion on external publicity, on the Xinhuas and all the TV and so on. And yet, look at the effect. But that's because they don't produce their stories to convince you and me. They produce their stories to show people at home how good they are, how national they are, and how they stood up for China. This extreme sensitivity to what the community does abroad and this desire to control what's in all Chinese newspapers around the world, all this, I think, reflects the authoritarian turn within China and the increasing centralization. It also, I think, reflects a certain amount of stress. Today, China spends more on internal security than she does on national defense. And what we're seeing being built in terms of a surveillance state, in terms of the coercive apparatus of the state, much of which is now actually undergoing rectification, that, I think, to my mind, is what is being reflected here. This is not a good time for any Chinese to be seen as deviating from the norm or trying to be liberal in a traditional sense. And I think some of what we see, especially the behavior, this wolf warrior behavior by Chinese diplomats and so on, I think can be explained by those changes at home. But it also is, I think, part of the other shift. Xi Jinping has moved China from Deng Xiaoping's hide and bide to center stage and to a form of universalism, which we heard again in the General Assembly speech, where China offers herself as a model, as somebody to be emulated. So we now have two models in the world. We have the city on the hill, the US. We also have China. You know, and China is trying to set international standards, norms through the BRI, whether it's on the internet and so on. She is now saying she's willing to join the TPP or the CPTPP. So this also leads to much more assertive Chinese policy abroad. So I think it's a double push.
So to go back to the wolf warriors, we see some of the wolf warriors, of course, at the moment in Chinese commentary on India. Mm-hmm. India and China had a military clash recently with loss of life. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the first since 1962?
Since 75, actually.
Since 75. There was a fear that there might be another one this year. That seems to have abated a little bit. It's a complicated territorial issue, but explain in your own words what you think happened. I mean, I had a sense that nobody really wanted this, but once it was joined, the Chinese joined it enthusiastically.
Well, for about 30 years, from the mid-80s onwards, the border has been basically stable, and both sides had signed a series of agreements from 1993 onwards, promising to respect the status quo, putting in place military CBMs, which kept it peaceful. But the relationship has deteriorated over the last few years. And the signs of stress were there in various ways. This spring, the Chinese tried to straighten the line of actual control in the Western sector. Partly in response, I mean, there are local military operational reasons for this. India has been playing catch up in terms of infrastructure on the border, has been building roads, opening up advanced landing grounds for aircraft near the LAC, the line of actual control. And as Indian infrastructure has improved, I think the Chinese have tried also to try and minimize the effects of those changes. So there are local military factors, but that doesn't explain why they would actually go against the various agreements and change their behavior in a fundamental way, bringing troops in, preventing Indian troops from patrolling where they had been patrolling before. Because there are areas where both sides patrol, both sides think is under their control. And in the past, there have been standard operating procedures to deal with these. But now the Chinese actually came and sat in these areas permanently, not just patrolling to show their presence, and prevented Indian patrols from going where they've been going for years. And we ended up with clashes, with the loss of life, as you said, the first time since 1975. But the military reasons don't explain why one would risk the relationship, take it close to war, in fact, and all the subsequent consequences. If China's goal was to keep India neutral between the US and China, as U.S.-China relations get worse, then surely this is guaranteed to push India into U.S. arms.
Is that the case?
Certainly, there's a lot of people in India who think that, yes, India now needs to rely and get much closer to the U.S. And the fact is that in the last few years, India-U.S. relations have really improved tremendously, especially in defense, security, intelligence, in the things that would bother the Chinese. But that is a fact. So I assume that the Chinese did this after having come to the conclusion that India-US relations have already got to the point where there's no point trying to keep India neutral. The best thing to do is to show the US that India cannot countervail China, and to show India that the US cannot help you in your problem on land with China. But I'm guessing here, because the Chinese are never going to tell you this. But it's rather like the South China Sea, where Chinese actions are also calculated to show the others, Vietnam and the others, that the US can't solve your problem. Come and talk to me. Deal with me.
One of the most interesting things for me is that this deterioration of that relationship along the border in particular, in very concrete terms, has happened while Mr. Modi and Xi Jinping have had an intensive one-on-one dialogue. So one wonders if the relationship will go downhill when you have top-level political dialogue. That's even more worrying, perhaps.
Well, they've had 18 meetings. And both of them, and this is interesting, both of them say they have a good relationship and so on. but that hasn't prevented this from happening. But if you look at statements at that level, they've been very careful in what they've said about each other. And both, I think, have tried to dial it down. But both are leaders who rely on nationalism for their legitimacy. So what we seem to be in for, therefore, is a period of much more adversarial relations. But in the last few weeks, starting with the meeting of the foreign ministers in Moscow on the 10th, and then day before yesterday when the commanders met, there have been joint statements which suggest an attempt at least to freeze the situation as it is, and then to see how we can disengage, de-escalate, and move back. Of course, both sides have seemed to have, at least in their statements, incompatible goals. The Indian side speaks of restoring the status quo as it was before April, before all this started. The Chinese side speaks of disengagement by both sides from the new status quo that they've already created. And here again, it sounds again like the South China Sea, you know, two steps forward, one step back.
I think you said something very interesting, if I remember correctly, that India cannot afford to have another propaganda victory while losing territory at the same time.
Well, so far, I think what we've seen and what the government is saying is that China has not actually crossed over into territory that was under our control. Bits that were disputed, they have now, which both sides claimed, they have now probably occupied. But the Indian response has been to fill in some vacant areas too, themselves. And both governments have been very parsimonious with the information that they've shared with us. So it's very hard to tell exactly where everyone is. So I'd be a bit careful jumping to conclusions on the operational details of, you know, which areas where and what they've actually done. But both seem to want to wind it down for the time being. And then winter will do the rest for them. I mean, because there's not much that's possible after November at those heights. You know, you're talking about 18,000 to 20,000 feet in some cases.
If I can switch topic just briefly, the coronavirus, India is now struggling with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. How has that played into foreign policy issues, particularly in the relationship with China?
Much less into foreign policy and much more into the domestic economy and so on, because I think the last quarter figures were much worse than anyone expected. But in terms of foreign policy, not much. There was some suspicion that one reason why the Chinese were able to try and come and sit in these areas was because the Indian Army didn't do its normal deployment because of COVID. But I don't think that's ever been quite confirmed. And the fact is that the Indian Army did deploy very rapidly after that. And you do now have large numbers of troops on both sides of the line in pretty close proximity to each other. So it's not yet solved. But I don't think COVID actually affected it directly. But COVID itself is a worry. Luckily, for the last a little more than a week, actually, the numbers of fresh cases are less than the number of recoveries.
Ultimately, of course, India's strength on the international stage is tied to the strength of your economy, and you want to see that bounce back.
That's really the trick. I think the trick that all of us are trying to find is how to open up the economy and get it going again without facing another wave of COVID.
Well, we're certainly struggling with that in Australia, which brings me to my final question. You observe, obviously, from a distance, Australia's handling of its relationship with China. We've had a very rough 2 to 3 years, and frankly, nobody expects things to get much better. People keep surprised it keeps getting worse. What is your sense of how that relationship has been managed by Australia from a distance?
Well, I think it's not an easy task. And in India, we face many of the same dilemmas. We have a very strong economic relationship with China. China used to be our largest trading partner until 2019, when the US overtook China. Secondly, we're an open society, and Chinese influence operations, whether it's Confucius Institutes or other forms of, in your case, I think. So I think actually there's been a lot of admiration for the way Australia's gone about this, staying open while trying to deal with the consequences of this relationship and the changed Chinese behavior. And I think we can learn a lot from each other. But also, I think clearly India-Australia relations have benefited from what we've seen happening around us, from the changes, from the increased uncertainty, not just with China, but in the region as a whole. And there's much more that I think we'll be doing on maritime security, on in the Indo-Pacific, and in the Quad Plus, I hope, which the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue. And I do hope that it also leads us to do much more on our own bilateral economic relationship, on the free trade agreement that we've been negotiating forever, even if we manage to find other ways of doing that. So there's admiration, I think, here for the way Australia has handled it, and a fair amount of sympathy, because I think we have many of the same problems, same dilemmas.
Yes, I think there's a lot of information sharing going on around the world these days about how best to manage China. And of course, there's no silver bullet with that. Well, look, thanks again, Shiv Shankar Menon, for joining me for today's discussion of Chinese foreign policy.
Thanks, Richard. Thank you very much for that.
COVIDcast is a limited edition podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thanks to my colleague, Jennifer Reinhardt, for her production assistance. And please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast. And you can stay up to date, of course, with all the latest developments on the coronavirus and other issues via the Lowy Institute's widely read digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and stay tuned for our next episode.